Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1092, The Destabilization of China, Part 3. This is being recorded on October 8th of the year 2019. We are continuing with analysis of what is going on in Hong Kong, or partial analysis of what is going on in Hong Kong and China. This is against the background of the full court press strategy that I reviewed briefly in our previous program, quoting from information from For the Record, Anti-Fascist Archives program number 37 from the late summer and fall of 1992, going back 27 years in our archives. I believe that the same strategy of economic pressure, unabated propaganda, both to shore up political will in this country and to foster what Paul Nitze, the author of MSC 68, termed the corrosive effects of nationalism in Hong Kong per se, combined with an economic full-court press strategy that worked very successfully against the former Soviet Union, as we looked at in AFA programs 36 and 37, and it is being employed, in my opinion, now in China as well. It remains to be seen how successful this is. We have been reading from an article from Consortium News of August 19th of 2019. That's by Dan Cohen from the Gray Zone. U.S. backs xenophobia and mob violence in Hong Kong. The article notes, and something that will be developed further, the strong links between American politicians and American, quote, soft power, unquote, political action organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy with the leaders of the Hong Kong disruptions. Whereas they are portrayed as pro-democracy protesters in this country, if there were people doing what they have been doing in this country, throwing Molotov cocktails at police, attacking police and tourists and police stations with everything from batons to bricks, and sabotaging subway trains and spraying racist slogans. Really, off the top of my head, can't think of an anti-American racist slogan, but they would not be termed pro-democracy protesters in this country. They would be called rioters and or terrorists. That was an example of newspeak, something that we will get into at greater length, if not in this program, an article in another article from the same day from Consortium News about what is going on in Hong Kong from an economic standpoint. The neoliberal policies being pursued in Hong Kong, which have seen roughly a 300% increase in rents for the last 10 years, while wages have remained roughly stagnant. That has plunged roughly 20% of Hong Kongers into the poverty zone, and the percentage of GDP in Hong Kong relative to that of mainland China is now a fraction of the same. That has left an awful lot of young Chinese, young Hong Kongers, I should say, understandably stressed, and has made them, in the era of smartphones and social media, and once again the internet, that has made them a fertile planting ground, to coin a term, for various kinds of destabilization and propaganda. in addition to Jimmy Lai, described as the Rupert Murdoch of Hong Kong. There are some other people who have been involved with the activities as well. Now, once again, from Consortium News of October 19th of 2019 by Dan Cohen, U.S. backs xenophobia and mob violence in Hong Kong. And resuming where we left off, besides Jimmy Lai, a large part of the credit for mobilizing latent xenophobia goes to the right-wing Hong Kong Indigenous Party leader Edward Leung, L-E-U-N-G. Under the direction of the 28-year-old Leung, his pro-independence party has brandished British colonial flags and publicly harassed Chinese mainland tourists. In 2016, Leung was exposed for meeting with U.S. diplomatic officials at a local restaurant. Though he is currently in jail for leading a 2016 riot where police were bombarded with bricks and pavement, and where he admitted to attacking an officer, Leung's racist politics and his slogan, Retake Hong Kong, have helped define the ongoing protests. A local legislator and protest leader described Leung to the New York Times as, quote, the Che Guevara of Hong Kong's revolution, unquote, referring without a hint of irony to the Latin American communist revolutionary killed in a CIA-backed operation. According to the Times, Leung is the closest thing Hong Kong's tumultuous and leaderless protest movement has to a guiding light. The xenophobic sensibility of the protesters has proved fertile soil for Hong Kong National Party to recruit. Founded by the pro-independence activist Andy Chan, C-H-A-N, the officially banned party combines anti-Chinese resentment with calls for the U.S. to intervene. Images and videos have surfaced of HKNP members waving the flags of the U.S. and U.K., singing the Star Spangled Banner, and carrying flags emblazoned with the images of Pepe the Frog, the most recognizable symbol of the U.S. alt-right. And remember that Steve Bannon, arguably the central figure in the U.S. alt-right, has revived the Committee on the Present Danger, a major vehicle for political action and destabilization against the former Soviet Union. And as I indicated, I believe the same full court press strategy that destroyed the Soviet Union is now being employed against China. It remains to be seen if it has the same effect. Last sentence again. Images and videos have surfaced of Hong Kong National Party members waving the flags of the U.S. and U.K., singing the Star Spangled Banner, and carrying flags emblazoned with images of Pepe the Frog, the most recognizable symbol of the U.S. alt-right. While the party lacks a wide base of popular support, it is perhaps the most outspoken within the protest ranks and has attracted disproportionate international attention as a result. Chan has called for Trump to escalate the trade war and accused China of carrying out a national cleansing, unquote, against Hong Kong. Quote, we were once colonized by the Brits, and now we are by the Chinese, he declared. Displays of pro-American jingoism in the streets of Hong Kong have been like catnip for the international far right. Patriot Prayer founder Joey Gibson, that's a right-wing activist group in the U.S., Patriot Prayer founder Joey Gibson recently appeared at an anti-extradition protest in Hong Kong, live streaming the event to his tens of thousands of followers. A month earlier, Gibson was seen roughing up Antifa activists alongside ranks of club-wielding fascists. In Hong Kong, the alt-right organizer marveled at the crowds. They love our flag here more than they do in America, Gibson exclaimed as marchers passed by, flashing him a thumbs-up sign while he waved the stars and stripes. Such xenophobic propaganda is consistent with the Clash of Civilizations theory that Jimmy Lai has promulgated through his media empire. Quote, you have to understand the Hong Kong people, a very tiny 7 million or 0.5% of the Chinese population, are very different from the rest of Chinese in China, because we grew up in the Western values, which was the legacy of the British colonial past, which gave us the instinct to revolt once this extradition law was threatening our freedom, unquote. Lai told Fox News, Maria Bartiromo, quote, even America has to look at the world 20 years from now, whether you want the Chinese dictatorial values to dominate this world, or you want the values that you treasure to continue. During a panel discussion at the neoconservative Washington-based think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Lai told the pro-Israel lobbyist Jonathan Schanzer, quote, we need to know that America is behind us. By backing us, America is also sowing to the will of their moral authority because we are the only place in China, a tiny island in China, which is sharing our values, which is fighting the same war you have with China, unquote. While Lai makes no attempt to conceal his political agenda, his bankrolling of central figures in the 2014 Occupy Central or Umbrella Movement protests was not always public. Leaked emails revealed that Lai poured more than $1.2 million into anti-China political parties during a including $637,000 to the Democratic Party and $382,000 to the Civic Party. Lai also gave $115,000 to the Hong Kong Civic Education Foundation and Hong Kong Democratic Development Network, both of which were founded by Reverend Chu Yu Ming. Lai also spent $446,000 on Occupy Central's 2014 unofficial referendum. Lai's U.S. consigliere is a former naval intelligence analyst who interned with the CIA and leveraged his intelligence connections to build his boss's business empire. Named Mark Simon, the veteran spook arranged for former Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin to meet with a group in the anti-China camp during a 2009 visit to Hong Kong. 5 years later, Lai paid $75,000 to neoconservative Iraq War author and U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz to organize a meeting with top military figures in Myanmar. This July, as the Hong Kong protests gathered steam, Lai was junketed to Washington, D.C. for meetings with Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and Republican Senators Ted Cruz, Cory Gardner, and Rick Scott. Bloomberg News correspondent Nicholas Wabhams, W-A-B-H-A-M-S, remarked on Lai's visit, quote, very unusual for a non-government visitor to get that kind of access, unquote. One of Lai's closest allies, Martin Lee, was also granted an audience with Pompeo and has held court with U.S. leaders, including Representative Nancy Pelosi and former Vice President Joseph Biden. Among the most prominent figures in Hong Kong's pro-U.S. political parties, Lee began collaborating with Lai during the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests. A recipient of the U.S.-funded National Endowment for Democracy's Democracy Award in 1997, Lee is the founding chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, now considered part of the U.S. A recipient of the U.S.-funded National Endowment for Democracy's Democracy Award in 1997, Lee is the founding chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, now considered part of the pro-U.S. camp's old guard. While Martin Lee has long been highly visible on the pro-Western Hong Kong scene, a younger generation of activists emerged during the 2014 Occupy Central protests with a new brand of localized politics. Joshua Wong was just 17 years old when the Umbrella Movement took form in 2014. After emerging in the protest ranks as one of the more charismatic voices, he was steadily groomed as the pro-West camp's teenage poster child. Wong received lavish praise in Time magazine, Fortune, and Foreign Policy as a freedom campaigner, unquote, and became the subject of an award-winning Netflix documentary called Joshua, Teenager versus Superpower, unquote. Unsurprisingly, these puff pieces have overlooked Wong's ties to the U.S. regime change apparatus. For instance, National Endowment for Democracy's National Democratic Institute, or NDI, maintains a close relationship with DEMOSISTO, D-E-M-O-S-I-S-T-O, the political party Wong founded in 2016, with fellow Umbrella Movement alumnus Nathan Law. In August, a candid photo surfaced of Wong and Law meeting with Julie Edeh, E-A-D-E-H, I may be mispronouncing that, the political counselor at the U.S. Consulate General in Hong Kong, raising questions about the content of the meeting and setting off a showdown between Washington and Beijing. Interrupting here briefly, just imagine if a Chinese diplomat, say, from the New York consulate, had met with Occupy Wall Street protesters or members of Black Lives Matter or anti-Trump demonstrators, imagine how that would be portrayed in the American media. Imagine how Americans would see that, worth keeping in mind. Reading again. In August, a candid photo surfaced of Joshua Wong and Law meeting with Julie Edeh, E-A-D-E-H, the political counselor at the U.S. Consulate General in Hong Kong, raising questions about the content of the meeting and setting off a diplomatic showdown between Washington and Beijing. The pro-Beijing Hong Kong newspaper Pak Kung Pao published personal details about Edeh, including the names of her children and her address. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas lashed out, accusing the Chinese government of being behind the leak, but offering no evidence. Quote, "I don't think that leaking an American diplomat's private information, pictures, names of their children, I don't think that is a formal protest. That is what a thuggish regime would do," she said at a State Department briefing. But the photo underscored the close relationship between Hong Kong's pro-West movement and the U.S. government. Since the 2014 Occupy Central protests have vaulted Wong into prominence, he and his peers have been assiduously cultivated by the elite Washington institutions to act as the faces and voices of Hong Kong's burgeoning anti-China movement. In September of 2015, Wong, Martin Lee, and University of Hong Kong law professor Benny Tai Lee were honored by Freedom House, a right-wing soft power organization that is heavily funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and other arms of the U.S. government. Just days after Trump's election as president in November of 2016, Wong was back in Washington to appeal for more U.S. support. Quote, "Being a businessman, I hope Donald Trump could know the dynamics in Hong Kong and know that to maintain the business sector benefits in Hong Kong, it's necessary to fully support human rights in Hong Kong to maintain the judicial independence and the rule of law," he said. Wong's visit provided occasion for the Senate's two most aggressively neoconservative members, Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton, to introduce the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which would, again, quoting, identify those responsible for abduction, surveillance, detention, and forced confessions, and the perpetrators will have their U.S. assets, if any, frozen, and their entry to the country denied. Wong was then taken on a junket of elite U.S. institutions, including the right-wing Heritage Foundation think tank and the newsrooms of the New York Times and Financial Times. He then held court with Rubio, Cotton, Pelosi, and Senator Ben Sasse. In September of 2017, Rubio, Ben Cardin, Tom Cotton, Sherrod Brown, and Cory Gardner signed off on a letter to Wong, Law, and fellow anti-China activist Alex Chow, praising them for their, quote, efforts to build a genuinely autonomous Hong Kong. The bipartisan cast of senators proclaimed, quote, the United States cannot stand idly by, unquote. A year later, Rubio and his colleagues nominated the trio of Wong, Law, and Chow for the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize. Washington's support for the designated spokesman of the Retake Hong Kong movement, unquote, was supplemented with untold sums of money from U.S. regime change outfits like the National Endowment for Democracy and subsidiaries like the National Democratic Institute to civil society, media, and political groups. As journalist Alex Rubenstein reported, the Hong Kong Human Rights Monitor, a key member of the coalition that organized against the now-defunct extradition law, has received more than $2 million in MEB funds since 1995. And other groups in the coalition reaped hundreds of thousands of dollars from the MED and NDI last year alone. While U.S. lawmakers nominate Hong Kong protest leaders for peace prizes and pump their organizations with money to, quote, promote democracy, unquote, the demonstrations have begun to spiral out of control. After the extradition law was scrapped, the protests moved into a more aggressive phase, launching hit-and-run attacks against government targets, erecting roadblocks, besieging police stations, and generally embracing the extreme modalities put on display during U.S.-backed regime change operations from Ukraine to Venezuela to Nicaragua. The techniques clearly reflected the training many activists have received from Western soft power outfits, but they also bore the mark of Jimmy Lai's media operation. In addition to the vast sums Lai spent on political parties directly involved in the protests, his media group created an animated video, quote, showing how to resist police in case force was used to disperse people in a mass protest, unquote. While dumping money into Hong Kong's pro-U.S. political camp in 2013, Lai traveled to Taiwan for a secret roundtable consultation with Xi Mengte, a key figure in Taiwan's social movement that forced then-President Chen Shui-bian to resign in 2008. Xi reportedly instructed Lai on nonviolent tactics to bring the government to heel, emphasizing the importance of a commitment to go to jail. According to journalist Peter Lee, quote, she supposedly gave Lai advice on putting students, young girls, and mothers with children in the vanguards of the street protests in order to attract the support of the international community and press, and to sustain the movement with continual activities to keep it dynamic and fresh, unquote. Lai reportedly turned off his recording device during multiple sections of Xi's tutorial. One protester explained to the New York Times how the movement attempted to embrace a strategy called marginal violence theory by using mild force, unquote, to provoke security services into attacking the protesters. The protesters aim to shift international sympathy away from the state. But as the protest movement intensifies, its rank and file are doing away with tactical restraint and lashing out at their targets with full fury. They have thrown Molotov cocktails into intersections to block traffic, attacked vehicles and their drivers for attempting to break through roadblocks, beaten opponents with truncheons, attacked a wounded man with a U.S. flag, menaced a reporter into deleting her photos, kidnapped and beat a journalist senseless, beat a mainland traveler unconscious, and prevented paramedics from reaching the victim, and hurled petrol bombs at police officers. The charged atmosphere has provided a shot in the arm to Lai's media empire, which had been suffering heavy losses since the last round of national protests in 2014. After the mass marches against the extradition bill on June 9th, which Lai's Apple Daily aggressively promoted, his next digital, that's his publication, capital N-E-X-T, and then capital D-I-G-I-T-A-L, doubled in value, according to AG Insight, that's capital E-J-I Insight. Meanwhile, the protest leaders show no sign of backing down. Nathan Law, the youth activist, celebrated in Washington and photographed meeting with U.S. officials in Hong Kong, took to Twitter to urge his peers to soldier on. Quote, "We have to persist and keep the faith, no matter how devastated the reality seems to be," he wrote. Law was tweeting from New Haven, Connecticut, where he was enrolled with a full scholarship at Yale University. While the young activist basked in the adulation of his U.S. patrons thousands of miles from the chaos he helped to spark, a movement that defined itself as a leaderless resistance, unquote, forged ahead back home. And we're going to talk next about not only the extradition law itself, but something about the neoliberal slash laissez-faire economics that hold sway in Hong Kong and that have resulted in, among other things, again, a 300% increase in rents over the last 10 years, while wages have basically stagnated. This has plunged roughly 20%, one-fifth of Hong Kong's 7 million people, into poverty. Hong Kong is now the most expensive city in the world, and it also is a major center of financial crimes as well. I suspect that the distaste for the extradition law itself may very well have had something to do with Hong Kong's position as an epicenter of economic crime. And no doubt some of the banksters who have wreaked some havoc in the U.S. and other countries are looking to Hong Kong as a place where they could perhaps hold course without fear of being extradited, certainly to China and perhaps nowhere else as well. Worth noting as well that its shortcomings notwithstanding, China's state capitalism, in which the government itself is the primary venture capital source for its growing commercial enterprises, has produced some remarkable changes. In 1981, 88% of the Chinese population was at or below the poverty line. 88% of the Chinese population. By 2015, 34 years later, that was down to 0.7%. That is a remarkable change. And the source for that is the World Bank, hardly an epicenter of communist ideology. Beyond that, in 2002, 4% of the Chinese population was middle class. That had increased to 31% at present. And that, again, comes from the World Bank, from the International Monetary Fund, the two principal institutions set up by the Bretton Woods Conference, and, by the way, from that major bastion of Marxist ideology and communist positivization, the Analysis Division of the CIA. One of the things to take note before we go into this article, which we may not have time to finish, is that the destabilization of China simply makes no sense from a business standpoint. I will ruminate, if not in this show, in our next, about what I think is behind it. But when you have the largest market in the world, China, which it is, you want the people there to have some money in their pockets. Capitalism is a system predicated upon the successful conduct of commerce. And you can't basically, you can't get people to buy things if they don't have money. And with the Chinese having gone from 88% poverty in 1981 to 0.7% in 2015, that is an important change. Perhaps even more importantly, it went, China's middle class population went from 4% in 2002 to 31%, almost an eightfold increase in less than two decades. And again, the source for that, among others, that well-known bastion of communist ideology and positivization, the Analysis Division of the CIA. Again, from simply a business standpoint, it makes no sense to be doing what they're doing. It would be better to be able to sell stuff, American tech products, American agricultural products, you name it, cars, what have you, or cars, and things from other countries to that big market. And the more money the Chinese have in their pockets, the more American product and products from other countries they can buy. So what is happening makes no sense from a strict business standpoint. Again, capitalism is a system predicated upon the successful conduct of commerce. To conduct commerce successfully, people have to be able to buy stuff. I mean, this is not rocket science. So that makes no sense. In our next program, we are going to talk about how the pending legislation in the U.S. now being endorsed in Germany would actually hurt Hong Kong's economy because they enjoy a special economic status as a result of the status quo and the legislation that the American far right and the people in Germany are backing against the wishes, by the way, of the German business community, would actually hurt Hong Kong. But more about that in our next show.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Another article from Consortium News and from the same date, August 19th of 2019, this is by Kevin Zeese, capital Z-E-E-S-E, and Margaret Flowers, F-L-O-W-E-R-S, Hong Kong in crosshairs of global power struggle, unquote. Hong Kong is one of the most extreme examples of big finance, liberal, beginning again, Hong Kong is one of the most extreme examples of big finance, neoliberal capitalism in the world. As a result, many people in Hong Kong are suffering from great economic insecurity in a city with 93 billionaires, the second most of any city on earth. Hong Kong is suffering from the effects of being colonized by Britain for more than 150 years following the Opium Wars. The British put in place a capitalist economic system, and Hong Kong has had no history of self-rule. When Britain left, it negotiated an agreement that prevents China from changing Hong Kong's political and economic systems for 50 years by making Hong Kong a special administrative region. This is worth noting because Americans generally are not aware of this. For the Chinese to replace the economic system in Hong Kong, which again has led to an enormous discontinuity or an enormous imbalance in economic distribution. 93 billionaires makes it the second of any city on earth in terms of number of billionaires resident there. And yet 20% of the 7 million people live below the poverty line. But for the Chinese to reorganize the Hong Kong economy, they would have to violate the agreement that they made with Britain. So they cannot do that. Resuming the discussion here and recapping our last couple of sentences, Hong Kong is suffering from the effects of being colonized by Britain for more than 150 years following the Opium Wars. The British put in place a capitalist economic system, and Hong Kong has had no history of self-rule. When Britain left, it negotiated an agreement that prevents China from changing Hong Kong's political and economic systems for 50 years by making Hong Kong a special administrative region, or SAR. China cannot solve the suffering of the people of Hong Kong. This one country, two systems approach means the extreme capitalism of Hong Kong exists alongside, but separate from China's socialized system. Hong Kong has an unusual political system. For example, half the seats in the legislature are required to represent business interests, meaning corporate interests vote on legislation. Hong Kong is a center for big finance and also a center of financial crimes. Between 2013 and 2017, the number of suspicious transactions reported to law enforcement agencies rocketed from 32,907 to 92,115. There has been a small number of prosecutions, which dropped from a high of 167 in 2014, that was also the year of the Umbrella Occupy Central movement, to 103 in 2017. Convictions dropped to only one person sentenced to more than 6 years behind bars in 2017. I don't think it is too much of a reach to see the relative legal impunity of financial crime in Hong Kong to being analogous in many ways to the relative criminal impunity that the architects of the 2008 financial collapse in this country experienced. None of them went to jail. And there was documented law-breaking. There is a really good documentary about the 2008 financial collapse called Inside Job, and I think people would do well to take a look at that and see what happened. Now, about the extradition bill, which keyed the current round of unrest. The stated cause of the recent protests is an extradition bill proposed because there is no legal way to prevent criminals from escaping charges when they flee to Hong Kong. The bill was proposed by the Hong Kong government in February of 2019 to establish a mechanism to transfer fugitives in Hong Kong to Taiwan, Macau, or mainland China. Extradition laws are a legal norm between countries and within countries, e.g. between states, and since Hong Kong is part of China, it is pretty basic. In fact, in 1998, a pro-democracy legislator, Martin Lee, whom we read about in our previous article, proposed a law similar to the one he now opposes to ensure that a person is prosecuted and tried at the place of their offense. The push for the bill came in 2018, when the Hong Kong resident Chang, of Chan, C-H-A-N, Tong Kai, capital T-O-N-G hyphen K-A-I, allegedly killed his pregnant girlfriend, Poon Yu Wing, in Taiwan, then returned to Hong Kong. Chan admitted he killed Poon to Hong Kong police, but the police were unable to charge him for murder or extradite him to Taiwan because no extradition agreement was in place. The proposed law covered 46 types of crime that are recognized as serious offenses around the globe. These include murder, rape, and sexual offenses, assaults, kidnapping, immigration violations, and drug offenses, as well as property offenses like robbery, burglary, and arson, and other traditional criminal offenses. It also included business and financial crimes. Months before the street protests, the business community expressed opposition to the law one more time. Months before the street protests, the business community expressed opposition to the extradition law. Hong Kong's two pro-business parties urged the government to exempt white-collar crimes from the list of offenses covered by any future extradition agreement. There was escalating pressure from the city's business heavyweights. The American Chamber of Commerce and CHAM, a 50-year-old organization that represents over 1,200 U.S. companies doing business in Hong Kong, also opposed the proposal. These last few sentences again, because we don't hear about this in the U.S. And again, it was this extradition law that keyed the current unrest. Months before the street protests, the business community expressed opposition to the law. Hong Kong's two pro-business parties urged the government to exempt white-collar crimes from the list of offenses covered by any future agreement. And begin again. Hong Kong's two pro-business parties urged the government to exempt white-collar crimes from the list of offenses covered by any future extradition agreement. There was escalating pressure from the city's business heavyweights. The American Chamber of Commerce and CHAM, a 50-year-old organization that represents over 1,200 U.S. companies doing business in Hong Kong, also opposed the proposal. AmCham said it would damage the city's reputation. Quote, any change in extradition agreements that substantially expands the possibility of arrest and rendition of international business executives residing in or transiting through Hong Kong as a result of allegations of economic crime made by the mainland government would undermine perceptions of Hong Kong as a safe and secure haven for international business operations, unquote. Kurt, K-U-R-T, Tong, T-O-N-G, the top U.S. diplomat in Hong Kong, said in March that the proposal could complicate relations between Washington and Hong Kong. Indeed, the Center for International Private Enterprise, an arm of the, drumroll fanfare please, National Endowment for Democracy, said the proposed law would undermine economic freedom, cause capital flight, and threaten Hong Kong's status as a hub for global commerce. By the way, when we get into our next article, which we probably won't have time to do in this one, that is exactly what the legislation that is coursing its way through the U.S. and also being endorsed in Germany would do. It would threaten Hong Kong's status as a hub for global commerce. Last sentence again. Indeed, the Center for International Private Enterprise, an arm of the National Endowment for Democracy, said the proposed law would undermine economic freedom, cause capital flight, and threaten Hong Kong's status as a hub for global commerce. They pointed to a bipartisan letter signed by 8 members of Congress, including Senators Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, and Steve Daines, D-A-I-N-E-S, and members of the House of Representatives Jim McGovern, Ben McAdams, Chris Smith, Tom Suozzi, S-U-O-Z-Z-I, and Brian Mast, opposing the bill. Proponents of the bill responded by exempting 9 of the economic crimes and made extradition only for crimes punishable by at least 7 years in prison. These changes, however, did not satisfy big business advocates. From this attention to the law, opposition grew with the formation of a coalition to organize protests. As Alexander Rubinstein reports, quote, the coalition cited by Hong Kong media, including the South China Morning Post and the Hong Kong Free Press, as organizers of the anti-extradition law demonstrations, is called Civil Human Rights Front. The organization's website lists the NED-funded HKRM, or Human Rights Monitor Hong Kong, Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions, the Hong Kong Journalists Association, the Civic Party, the Labor Party, and the Democratic Party as members of the coalition, unquote. HKHRM alone received more than $1.9 million in funds from the NED between 1995 and 2013. Major protests began in June. Building the anti-China movement in Hong Kong has been a long-term NED project since 1996. In 2012, NED invested $460,000 through its National Democratic Institute to build the anti-China movement, aka pro-democracy movement, particularly among university students. 2 years later, the mass protests of Occupy Central occurred. In a 2016 open letter to Kurt Tong, these NED grants and others were pointed out, and Tong was asked if the U.S. was funding a Hong Kong independence movement. During the current protests, organizers were photographed meeting with Julie Ide, the political unit chief of the U.S. Consulate General, in the Hong Kong Hotel. They also met with China hawks in Washington, D.C., including Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Senator Marco Rubio, and Representative Elliot Engel, Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Larry Diamond, a co-editor of the NED's publication and a co-chair of research, has been openly encouraging the protesters. He delivered a video message of support during their rally this weekend. Protests have included many elements of U.S. color revolutions with tactics such as violence, attacks on bystanders, media, police, and emergency personnel. Similar tactics were used in Ukraine, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, e.g. violent street barricades. U.S. officials and media criticized the government's response to the violent protests, even though they have been silent on the extreme police violence against the yellow vests in France. Demonstrators also used swarming techniques and sophisticated social media messaging targeting people in the U.S. Again, note the role of the Internet, mobile technology, and social media in all of this. Continuing, mass protests have continued. On July 9th, Chief Executive Carrie Lam pronounced the bill dead and suspended it. Protesters are now calling for the bill to be withdrawn, Lam to resign, and the police to be investigated. For more on the protests and U.S. involvement, listen to our interview with K.J. No on Clearing the Fog. The next section, what is driving discontent in Hong Kong? A source of unrest in Hong Kong is the economic insecurity stemming from laissez-faire capitalism. In 1997, Britain and China agreed to leave, quote, the previous capitalist system in place for 50 years. Hong Kong has been ranked as the world's freest economy in the Heritage's Index of Economic Freedom since 1995, when the index began. In 1990, Milton Friedman described Hong Kong as the best example of a free market economy. Its ranking is based on low taxes, light regulations, strong property rights, business freedom, and openness to global commerce. Graham Maxton writes in the South Morning Post, quote, the only way to restore order is through a radical change in Hong Kong's economic policies. After decades of doing almost nothing and letting the free market rule, it is time for the Hong Kong government to do what it is there to do, to govern in the interests of the majority, unquote. The issue is not the extradition proposal, Carrie Lam, or China. What we are witnessing is an unrestricted neoliberal economy described as a free market on steroids. Hong Kong's economy relative to China's gross domestic product, or GDP, has fallen from a peak of 27% in 1993 to less than 3% in 2017. During this time, China has had tremendous growth, including in nearby market-friendly Shenzhen, while Hong Kong has not. As Sarah Flounders writes, quote, for the last 10 years, wages have been stagnant in Hong Kong, while rents have increased 300%. It is the most expensive city in the world. In Shenzhen, wages have increased 8% every year, and more than 1 million new public green housing units at low rates are nearing completion. One more time. For the last 10 years, wages have been stagnant in Hong Kong while rents have increased 300%. It is the most expensive city in the world. In Shenzhen, wages have increased 8% every year and more than 1 million new public green housing units at low rates are nearing completion, unquote. Hong Kong has the world's highest rents, a widening wealth gap, and a poverty rate of 20%. In China, the poverty rate fell from 88% in 1981 to 0.7% in 2015, according to the World Bank. Ellen Brown writes in Neoliberalism Has Met Its Match in China that the Chinese government owns 80% of banks, which make favorable loans to businesses and subsidizes worker costs. the U.S. views China subsidizing its economy as an unfair trade advantage, while China sees long-term planned growth as smarter than short-term profits for shareholders. The Chinese model of state-controlled capitalism, some call it a form of socialism, has lifted 800 million people out of poverty and built a middle class of over 420 million people, growing from 4% in 2002 to 31%. The top 12 Chinese companies on the Fortune 500 are all state-owned and state-subsidized, including oil, solar energy, telecommunications, engineering, construction companies, banks, and the auto industry. China has the second largest GDP and the largest economy based on purchasing power GDP, according to the CIA, IMF, and World Bank. China continues to have significant problems, however. There are thousands of documented demonstrations, strikes, and labor actions in China annually, serious environmental challenges, inequality, and social control through the use of surveillance technology. I'm glad that isn't happening here. Can you imagine if there was serious economic inequality and environmental challenges and, above all, surveillance technology? Man, I'm so glad we don't have that problem here. Just imagine. Obviously, I am being sarcastic. Resuming with the article, how China responds to these challenges is a test for their governments. China describes itself as having an intra-party democracy. The 8 other legal democratic parties that are allowed to participate in the political system cooperate with but do not compete with the Communist Party. There are also local elections for candidates focused on grassroots issues. China views Western democracy and economics as flawed and does not try to emulate them, but is creating its own system. China is led by engineers and scientists, not by lawyers and business people. It approaches policy decisions through research and experimentation. Every city and every district is involved in some sort of experimentation, including free trade zones, poverty reduction, and education reform. There are pilot schools, pilot cities, pilot hospitals, pilot markets, pilot everything under the sun. The whole China is basically a giant portfolio of experiments with mayors and provincial governors as primary investigators. In this system, Hong Kong could be viewed as an experiment in neoliberal capitalism. The Communist Party knows that to keep its hold on power, it must combat inequalities and shift the economy towards a more efficient and more ecological model. Beijing has set a date of 2050 to become a socialist society, and to achieve that, it seeks improvements in social, labor, and environmental fields. We'll conclude this article and begin with analysis of some more articles about Hong Kong in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1092, The Destabilization of China, Part 3. This is being recorded on October 8th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.